Now, Podcast One brings you Spike's Car Radio, a downloadable cars and coffee hosted by writer, comedian, and automotive enthusiast Spike Ferriston. Now, here's Spike.
All right, welcome to Spike's Car Radio. Here we are again. We're in the Beverly Hills studio. It's lovely here. It's I bet you noticed the audio's better. We're more comfortable. We're in air-conditioned settings, Zuckerman. It's nice, isn't it?
I like air conditioning.
And today we have Porsche racing driver Patrick Long coming in. He's going to be in any minute. Do you you know who Pat Long is, right? You've met Pat Long.
Pat Long is a very accomplished racer for Porsche.
That's good. First correct answer from Zuckerman.
I don't get this stuff wrong.
Do you race? Do you like racing? I know we've been on the track together. Do you enjoy that experience?
I love it. It's exhilarating. Now, I wish there was a track like Willow Springs or one of the bigger tracks right in the heart of Los Angeles.
Right.
You know, they're a little far to get to.
Yeah, there's that other place towards Palm Springs.
What Thermal. Is
that? The Thermal, yeah.
And there's a couple of others at the Bud and Willow.
It's really nice, but like you're saying, it's a little bit of a jaunt, right?
It's a schlep.
And whenever you get to Willow, have you noticed it's always suddenly it's very windy there and very hot and...
It's desolate there. There is a certain otherworldly, after the end of times, apocalyptic feel out there in the middle of nowhere.
And everybody says the same thing. I bet they're cooking meth in that shack right there as you drive up.
Oh, I know they are.
When we were out there last? We were out there last with Seinfeld, right?
2 or 3 years ago.
Right. What cars did we have out there?
We had...
Was that the Brumos 4.0? We had a lot of Jerry stuff, right? Not a lot of our stuff. We don't own a lot of race cars between us. Right. But I think, was the 962 out there? Jerry's 962, his 917, his 908.3. Was it that time?
Well, I think you're conflating both times, but he
conflation.
Always... Conflation. But he had some real heavy metal, and then he had that racer from the 60s and 70s. His name was John...
I
don't remember his last name, but he was very competitive in the 60s, if I recall,
mm-hmm.
and he drove those cars at speed,
right,
around the track for us, and that was fascinating.
That's when you know you've made it. You don't only have the cars in the track; you hire a guy to do laps for you, and you just sit and watch.
And he was going fast. He was all out.
There's nothing like it, though. I mean, if you're gonna own a race, it's kind of the problem with just owning a race car is unless you have a license plate on it. Right? You don't really get to use it but maybe once a year unless you're one of these nut job retirement rich guys who goes out to the track like in Monterey and races. Do you want to do that? Have you ever thought, like, I want to get up and mix it up on a track?
I'm not at that stage yet. And I personally, I don't trust anybody else on the track that's a rich old guy. I wouldn't want to be anywhere near them. And they shouldn't want to be anywhere near me. I'm not a pro.
What's your favorite race car? What would you want to race if you could?
That Jerry's 908.3.
Have you driven that car?
No, you have. I haven't.
That car is spectacular and easy to drive and probably second only to his IROC RSR in how easy it is to use and the feedback you get from the street. But it feels like your head is on the front of a freight train.
Well,
that's how
is.
Far
it
forward
is.
You are.
It's kind of the car that was in Speed Racer in a way, where mm-hmm. you sit on top of the car in essence.
Legs in front of the front axle, so your legs are extending beyond the front wheels of the car.
That doesn't sound dangerous.
No, not at all.
No.
It's only dangerous when you hit the wall.
Well, aren't your legs stronger than the axle?
You
break through. You break through the wall
no.
with your legs.
So if I crashed in a 908.3, Zuckerman, would you be able to sue Porsche? You're a lawyer. Would you have a case against them?
Of course not. First, it's assumption of the risk. You're getting in and doing something dangerous. You can't complain later
right.
when your dangerous activity goes wrong.
Right. So I'm just done. Right?
You're just effed.
I'm effed. All right. Well, look who it is. Patrick Long has just walked in. Here he is. Come on in, Patrick. He's got a box. I think he brought a cake for us, some sort of Porsche. Oh, there's Will, our producer, who's
late.
Will, you're 10 minutes late.
Fired.
Hey, Patrick Long.
What's up?
How are you, man?
What's in the box, dude?
I come bearing gifts.
No way.
Here, sit.
This isn't a plug. These are long overdue.
Sit at the mic. They can't hear you unless you're talking.
Sorry.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you guys.
What do you have in the box there?
A long overdue gift for each of you and Jerry, as you guys helped give me some advice on producing our Luftgekult book.
Oh, yeah, so, that's right. Yeah. The Luftgekult book. Are we in the Luftgekult book?
You guys are. You guys star in it.
Well, that's amazing. You know the real Zuckerman right here.
You've met thank him. You.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you again. I can't pronounce Luftgekult really very well. That's the best I've ever done.
That was
done.
The plan. Yeah, yeah, that was actually really, yeah. really
see,
close.
See, because he's Jewish, it just those German words just don't, they don't come out, do they, Zuckerman?
Did you just out me? I don't think anybody ever knew I was Jewish.
Well, no, you don't think so?
Right into the politics.
Let's talk Luftgekult since you brought it up. We just had our third Luftgekult, right? Our
biggest, fourth.
Our fourth.
Yes.
Our biggest and our best. Where did this idea come from?
I mean, it's like you guys know and talk about cars and live through cars. It's all about community. For me, being with Porsche as a racing driver, I got dragged into a lot of different events and found that there was something I was missing and just wanted to take a stab at it. Irvine Cars and Coffee was sort of wrapping up and LA was sort of searching for something. And the other part of it was just the non-car people who had come up to one of my vintage 911s and had a ton of questions, as you guys get all of the time. And I realized that the youth was interested in a vintage 911. And I thought, what if we could just put on a Sunday morning that wasn't too early, that had good food and good music and a vast range of people? And so that's where it grew out of.
Yeah, it was pretty wild. I mean, I remember when you first told me about it, the thing that I really liked about it was you said, no one is going to come up to you and tell you have the wrong side mirrors on your car. The wrong lens. This is just about guys who love air-cooled machines.
Yeah, I mean, you know what it's like. Anything that you want to approach, and if you go to a super nerd festival, a Comic-Con level thing, you quickly feel like you're on the outside.
Yeah, and I made it to the second one. The first one, I was with you, Zuckerman, and with Jerry, and it was at Deus Ex Machina.
I did not go. That was number one.
No, I know. I'm saying we did not go.
We did
we
not
all
go.
Made we... this group decision that it was going to be like, that is too small, and there are going to be a million people there. This
and
thing
we
is
won't
so
be
big.
Able to park.
And we're not gonna, let's go to
snaps.
Bill's and have coffee. But the whole coffee, we were like, what's going on at Luftgekult? I wonder what those guys are up to.
That's what I really compliment them on. I've never liked the car show scene because of the nerdiness. You know, guys in cargo pants with their little box
right.
of bolts.
That's still happening.
It is. And that's kind of like the lit show in a way. And I was surprised when we went to number two, the Bandito Brothers. I was just so surprised at the mix of people.
It was great.
It was fantastic.
And there's... And the Bandito Brothers, you know, another moment where I remember because I had 8-Ball down there and he said, you know, bring him whenever, show up whenever, leave whenever. Just there was no pressure to stay. That's why I don't show cars. I don't want to get there at 6 in the morning and then have to stand around till 2:30 in the afternoon or 3 having lots of tiny conversations with, you know, with people and just really just, you know, commiserating waiting for a car to leave. Your thing is kind of like you can show up and you can leave when you want.
Yeah, it's obviously evolved a little bit. The first show that you guys talk about was 40 cars and 200-300 people. We didn't promote it. We sort of just threw it up a couple days before and printed a T-shirt and a poster and said, come down. And 4 years later, we were over 1,000 air-cooled cars this May at San Pedro that both of you came to. Thank you. And 6,000 people. And soon I've felt that we've become a victim of our own success because now it's permitting, it's police, it's there is more structure, but we're still working hard to keep the structure relaxed and keep the enthusiasm high because we've seen it with Monterey Car Week just coming back. It gets so big that in some ways it can be diluted. I love all these events. I go to the Lit Show, I go to Car Week, I go to Amelia, and I love being a part of that sort of unique character. And for us, I guess that's the goal, to maintain our own unique nature and not get washed out like everything else.
What's the ultimate plan for Luftgekult? Is it, you know, are you making money on this? Is it purely the passion? Is it Porsche because you're a Porsche factory driver? What is driving this, Patrick Long?
A friend of mine, Howie Idelson, who's a Southern California creative director, his wife, Laura, had a great tagline. She looked at us across the table as we were trying to figure out what the hell we were doing. And she said, this is a great side hustle. So, yeah, it's a passion project. Obviously, we have young families, each of us.
Right.
Full time. I travel 200 days a year. So to pull one show off right now is a lot of work. But I think it's been my college education. I left school at 16 to fly to Europe and race full time and did my studies on the road. And so I didn't get a traditional education. I didn't go to college. So if anything, this is reverse engineering things that I've learned through hanging out with successful people in the car world. And that's really what it is right now. It's we're just kind of making it up as we go. And we'll see what
evolves. And seeing where it ends up. Because yeah. It could end up being a content destination. It could end up being, you know, I don't know. All I know is like it just exponentially gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And one of two things happens in that situation. When the cars and coffee gets too big, somebody shuts it down.
You need to
sign up a state or a football stadium or something to put this, or you can't do it anymore.
Or
right?
You get a schism. You get a sect breaks off and says, we're going to go back to the pure Luftgekult. You know, they've lost their way. The church lost its way, and we're getting back to originalism.
The purist.
And believe me, they're already out there.
I know.
Really?
They're trying. One thing we have that they don't have are guys like you who are a part of the car community and legitimate supporters. And mm-hmm. So thank you for keeping us relevant.
But that's not – that. It's nice of you to say, but it's really not what drives it. I mean, what I notice is there are a lot of young people there. And for the first time, women at a car show.
Never saw that before.
Food trucks and beer and this relaxed atmosphere and all the guys that we, you know, the older guys in the Porsche thing, they all seem to stand around going, what is this? I don't understand. But what's dawning on them is they're out. This is the end of them. They're being pushed to the outside of the circle and there's a new generation of Porsche people. We hear this all the time that there's no kids involved in the hobby. How are we going to get the kids involved? Come to Luftgekult. And you're going to see that that's a ridiculous thing to even say. We just talking about it yesterday, kids don't drive cars. Kids aren't interested. I don't even understand that statement. Do you?
I don't. I see my son is 16, so I see some of his friends lagged on getting their permit. I know I couldn't wait to get my permit. It had to be on day number one. I had to get the license as soon as possible. But kids, if a car is available, a kid loves a car. And I've got my kind of wonky theories that 911s are relevant because they're still 911s. There was a 911 in 63. There's a 911 in 2017. So there's a continuum that a kid can look at it, aspire to a 2017 911 and see the relationship to an older car. That said, you know what blows me away about Luftgekult? When I look at it, I just start thinking about how many hours of prep time and production time are involved in this. And I really have to think that if you aggregated the time, you'd be doing at least 3 months of work.
Yeah, are you working on it right now? Or are you thinking about the next one?
Yeah, it's been a year-round process. Obviously, there's concentrated months. It is 3 months of full labor prep. This year, we had a team of five that was on it for 3 months. And then on the day of, our staff was probably over 30. That is, again, a good problem to have. But we try to keep it mixed. We want to go to different venues. We want to introduce the car guy to a new venue like Modernica Furniture, mid-century modern furniture, Bandito Brothers being from the creative world and a production house. And we'll see what comes of the next one. But yeah, it's certainly a different outcome than what I had planned.
Does Porsche get involved at all?
They've been sort of supportive as friends, and they've helped with advice. We've even leaned on Porsche Classic for some help with staffing and things like that. So they're keeping an eye on us, but they have their hands full with their own events. I mean, we just saw the announcement of Rennsport for next year, 2018, up at Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca. So there's some collaboration there, but I think part of the spirit of Luftgekult is that it's not about selling. It's really just about celebrating. And we'll see if we can maintain that purity as things get more expensive, as the show grows. But there will be a time when we're going to have to be a little more selective on cars and maybe a cap on the amount of people who come in, because we don't want to go to stadiums. We don't want to go to racetracks. We don't want to go to parking lots. We really want to take you inside of the architecture of Los Angeles and the culture of Los Angeles. And so that means keeping it pretty centrally located. The girls don't want to drive 2 hours to the middle of the desert,
no.
As you guys know. So we have a few challenges on our hands.
The guys don't either. Where were we close to Long Beach last time?
Yeah, we were already complaining about that. I loved Modernica because it really felt like a 1970s TV mm-hmm. set where some 70s detective was going to shoot a guy off of one of those old tin buildings.
Yeah, Kerry Morse, who's an avid collector that you guys know, he said, this feels like Gamund, you know. Right. There was old rustic signs and lots of corrugated rusted metal, and we didn't create any of it. Jay, the founder, he basically cut some weeds and said, good luck, I'm a car guy, I'll be here as a fan. And that's the type of car guy connection that's really helped this thing evolve, is that everybody has some buddy in their company who loves cars, and that's been our unfair advantage in planning.
Now, the books and the merch, are they available year round? Like with this book that you're giving us here, is there a Luftekult site where people can go and the merch is available for sale? And because I remember the first couple of times you had to buy the t-shirts early or they sold out immediately.
Yeah, we right? focus on event shirts and event posters. We hand screen the posters on site for the event, and once they're sold, they're sold. The leftovers, if there are leftovers, go up on our website, which mm-hmm. is luftekult.com. And after that, it's just been about little pieces of continuation of the event, but really the day of is where we focus on merch, because that's not our full-time gig. It's just an additional perk to coming along. But the book, Luft Book, has its own website, and you can Google that. And yeah, it's been another journey for me in an education with Howie in creating a coffee table book. I mean, you think these things go together like a little wedding book, but I mean, mm-hmm. that's 6 months of conference calls and reviews and creative and direction. And I drive race cars. That's all I've ever done. So I get burst into these scenes with real people who have real experience in education, and it's been great. And I try not to be that founder who has an opinion on everything and really just listen to the people that are at the table who know what they're doing.
Yeah, and the day of, you're running around. I notice, you know, we stop and say hello, and then you're like, bing! Yeah. You have to get to the next spot. What are your responsibilities on that day? What are you doing?
Yeah, someone call me that, like, corner coffee shop mm-hmm. owner, operator, micromanager.
Yeah.
I've tried to get away from that because I've realized that there's way too much real estate for one micromanager to hold all the keys to.
I didn't say it was micromanaging. It just seemed like you had a lot to do. Like, there were things going wrong. You were going to handle them, and we weren't going to feel the brunt of that.
Well, that's the goal. I think this has been sort of a compilation of relationships and mm-hmm. people that I've met along the way in the Porsche world. So in many aspects, I don't want to hand phone numbers out, so I sort of become the scheduler, the coordinator, the
right.
parking guy. And
mm-hmm.
it's been fun to evolve and to delegate, which is something that I don't really know about because I mm-hmm. haven't run a real business. But it's certainly, when it's that frantic and there are that many cars and that many passionate people, you learn the hard way that you have to trust your team. And it's been fun. Everybody who has come on officially is a Porsche guy, a classic guy. They speak the language, and I think that's been the fun part, is that it's just, again, community. I mean, we sort of run it like a charity event, and you've seen and been involved and probably put your own charity events on. Sometimes you get a CEO of a Fortune 500 company that puts more blood, sweat, and tears into his mm-hmm. own charity part, and that's what I feel like. Sometimes my team, they'll see me on the phone between race series, and they're like, are you even here this weekend, or mm-hmm. are you just living Luftekult? And I've had to be really careful to balance that, because competition on the racetrack is for hundredths of a second, so you have to be 110%
right.
when you get in the car.
We're here with Porsche factory driver Patrick Long. We'll be back in a minute. When you're looking to buy a car, you want to make sure that you're getting real pricing on actual inventory. Unfortunately, a lot of times this isn't the case. People configure cars online only later to find out they're not available, Zuckerman. So with TrueCar, you get real pricing on actual inventory. This is not pricing offered by TrueCar, but pricing from actual dealers. And not just any dealer, but a TrueCar certified dealer. This is carefully curated network of dealers committed to transparency and offering you a competitive market price. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the car you want. Next, TrueCar will show you what other people in your area paid for the same car you're looking for. Now you know what a fair price is, so you can feel confident. Don't you want to feel confident when you're buying a car?
I'm sold.
You're sold. Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by TrueCar certified network dealers. There are 13,000 TrueCar certified dealers nationwide.
Wow.
Do you understand?
This
Nobody
is a big deal.
Wants the bad dealership experience anymore, and TrueCar is going to get you out of it. You will work directly with a TrueCar certified dealer contact. TrueCar users are more likely to enjoy a faster buying process when they connect with TrueCar certified dealers. TrueCar users save an average of over $3,000 over MSRP. what do they call the MSRP? What's the name for that sticker?
Manufacturer's suggested retail price.
There it is. Don't take my word for it. Take Zuckerman's word. When you're ready to buy, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. I'm not going to tell you what features or what states. That's not my job.
Do you want to be great at reading body language, developing persuasion and influence, as well as master rapport and social interaction? What if I told you that you would learn from top performers like NBA superstar Shaquille O'Neal, former CIA director Michael Hayden, and brilliant thinkers like Dirty Jobs' Mike Rowe? Take a minute right now and subscribe to the Art of Charm podcast with me, Jordan Harbinger, and you'll hear how I pull out the secret psychology, life experience, and wisdom that can only be learned from them. You'll hear Shaq talk about how to manage your career and how to know who to trust when everyone's out to get something from you. You'll discover how to think critically from Bill Nye and Neil deGrasse Tyson, and even how Tony Hawk's life as a skateboard icon will influence how you think about your career and relationships in a whole new way. This show is for you if you want to outcompete, outperform, and outthink everyone around you, and it's the only place you'll get practical, applicable strategies from every single episode. Since you're all about learning from the absolute best, download and subscribe for free right now and upgrade your brain 4 times a week at podcastone.com or in the Podcast One app.
You're listening to Spike's Car Radio.
All right, we're back with Patrick Long and the real Zuckerman. You know, Patrick Long, one of 10 Porsche factory drivers and the only American. Is that true? Is that a fake fact that I read?
The team's evolved a little bit because of LMP1, and we have some junior team members.
Right.
We have some senior team
members. Let's just back up. What is a Porsche factory driver?
Well, during the week, we drive forklifts. We offload all of our spare parts, and then on the weekend, we get to test drive cars
if we're lucky.
And, yeah,
That's a very rare race car driver joke, Zuckerman. Did you hear it?
I'm very dry, you know. Factory couldn't be, you know, if you think about factory.
Yeah, but just for people who don't know, because a lot of people aren't, you know, car people listening, what does a factory driver do? What job is that? Because I'm not even sure that I understand it.
And I made that dumb sarcasm because it's a tough name, actually.
Right.
They call it Werksdriver in German. You're basically an extended arm of the factory in Weissach, where all of R&D for street cars and all of motorsport are developed inside of these sort of Area 51 gates, about 30 minutes from where production is at Zuffenhausen. So, they have their in-house drivers. That started with, I believe, Herbert Lange way back in the day, who was a Weissach resident and was like a guy who could drive, could come up the hill, shake down a 718 and then go back to working wherever he was working. And it's evolved into being an ambassador and a full-time member of Porsche's racing team.
So let's back up to this part. So you're a guy, they say, we've got the new GT3 ready. And they've got 10 of you out there. Can you guys come in, take it around the track, and tell us what you think? Are you giving them feedback about it? Are you just the guy who takes it up to speed so they can get feedback themselves? You know, is that what it is?
Yeah. Well, there's a team on GT cars for street car, you know, the GT3, GT2 RS, etc.
Right.
They have a development team of drivers.
Are you on that team?
No, because we are flying around the world racing, but we do get to sample in. If we're in Weissach and we run into that team, they'll throw us the keys to a development car that's still in camo.
Have you driven the GT2 RS?
I have not.
You haven't
I just
yet.
Came out of the new GT3, but I have not been given a
hand.
So.
Pleasantly surprised.
Really?
Well,
did you drive the PDK or the manual?
Surprised and pleasantly surprised. So my biggest surprise was the manual transmission. When I got into the Gen 1 991 GT3, first time we went to PDK, I was kind of like the rest of the fans of a GT3, rolling my eyes like it'll never be the same, etc. You guys have talked about this. When I took it up the snake, I was convinced this was the best street car I'd ever driven, and that's not Porsche spiel. So when I jumped into the manual—
So wait, you had the new GT3 out here?
Yeah, the first-gen GT3.
The first-gen, right.
Then I jumped into Gen 2, which is what we've just launched up at Monterey Car Week. We had a press event, and we were running them at Thunder Hill on last Tuesday. And so now I sort of am a convert. I drive a PDK, a GTS daily.
Me too.
And I feel almost guilty in saying that, but it's so good. And
it's
I can
so
still
good.
Experience
right.
a manual driving style, but I can drink coffee and sit in
yeah.
Beverly Hills traffic.
No, I know. So have you driven the manual transmission second generation GT3? And
damn good because...
Are you going to be okay, though? You're exactly who I want to talk to right now. You're enjoying your PDK.
Yes.
For these reasons that I've stated many times, you can use this card during the week.
Right.
It's just so nice to have something like that that does everything.
Right.
Do I really want to go back and start shifting gears in this new car?
I'm still on the fence. What I would say is, what are you going to be doing with your GT3? If you're going to the track and you're putting a sticker on the side of the door and you're competing for lap times, you stay with the PDK.
Okay.
Because you're going to daily drive it there. You're going to be happy. You're going to be quicker on the track because you're probably not at the level where you can better the computers these days. But if you're a Canyon Chaser guy, you drive your GT3 on the weekend, you don't care about lap times, you don't daily drive it, manual, no question.
Really?
Wow, there you go. So that's the 911R theory, Zuckerman.
So the solution is you keep your 991.1 PDK, and then you get the second generation stick, and you have one of each.
Maybe get just every version of the GT3 and have 10 GT3s.
I agree. I like to corner. I want to corner the market.
I was in Zuckerman's hangar the other day, and there are these little post-it notes on the windshield. Registration expired. Needs gas. Needs tune-up. Everything. It was too many car problems.
We talked about this.
I don't want to have that. I don't like that.
I like it. I like it.
Doesn't make you anxious?
Yeah,
it made me. When I looked at it, I went, "Oh, I got to get out of here."
You know what it's
There's
like?
So much work.
I'd laugh. It's like when the fire alarms all go blinky at one time.
Yes.
The light bulbs all go out at once, and the cars are the same way. They all take a crap at the same time.
Right, they do. Yeah. And then you're trying to hack through them with your machete.
I have two analogies. One is the crazy cat lady, and she justifies having 12 cats in her 800 square foot house. That's what I feel like when I tell people why I need a 66912 and a 1991 C2.
Yes.
But the other one is there are people who walk onto an airplane with just an iPhone. They don't have hand luggage. They don't have a backpack. They don't have anything. And then there's me. I walk onto the plane with a mountain climbing backpack with 20 magazines in it because I'm so scared I might be bored one day that I have to have many projects. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I never open up any of those magazines.
Do you have a big car collection?
Not a big car collection. It's modest in size and modest in value, but I like to sort of play and have diversity.
And what kind of cars do you have? What do you like?
I'm pretty much Porsche 911. I have
so you have a 912.
A couple of family heirlooms that are not Porsche.
Oh, yeah? What are those?
1930 Model A Roadster, original steel body, sort of rat rod without the rust.
Mm-hmm.
A 60 T-Bird, which was my grandfather's big boat.
So was Grandpa the car guy in the family? Is that where this all started?
He was. He was a son of a barber who cut hair until he was 93 in downtown L.A. and a very frugal father. And my grandpa went the opposite direction. He was all about sex, drugs, rock and roll, and hot rod cars. So he owned a gas station in Burbank, Glendale, in the heyday of 50s and 60s hot rodding. And circle track racing was where my family went as fans. They went to the original Ascot, to Gilmore, to where the heyday of open wheel dirt racing was. And then, of course, Porsches. I mean, my family were pickup people and Detroit Iron people. So Porsches was new just through opportunity for me in racing.
And when did you know you were going to race?
Well, at 6 years old, it's all I cared about. I wasn't really into friends. I wasn't
first
good at
grade.
Sticking
How
spot.
Do you? What do you mean you only cared about racing in first grade?
Well, that's all I wanted to do was watch racing on TV. I had a $75 go-kart that my uncle had found at a garage sale, and I would go into the garage and just start it up and run it on the stand until my dad came home. I was probably high on carbon monoxide because the door was closed. But, great health choices at 6 years old by yourself with a go-kart in the garage. So.
And you just wanted to get on the track. That's all. What kind of racing were you watching on TV?
Everything. Anything that ESPN Speed World had on. I mean, swamp buggies to Group C heyday, IMSA GT racing.
And your dad's a surfer at this point? A professional surfer?
No, he's a hippie surfer. So he's a carpenter building staircases in suburbia Los Angeles and surfing after and before work and on the weekends and just trying to get me and my brother to go to the beach. But my little brother became a skateboard fiend and I became a go-karter.
That's Spanky.
Spanky.
So there's a little bit of that from my dad.
Do you have a cool nickname like Spanky?
No, I have a lot of red hair related names. Maybe some with my first name being Pat and my last name being Long. So lately they call me Plongy because
the
Australians.
So where does it go? I want to get back to the Porsche driving, but you're a 6-year old in first grade, obsessed with racing. where does it go? Usually when you hear the story of someone climbing the ladder of being a professional driver, they have the rich dad that's going to go, I'm going to get you all the stuff, and you're going to do the programs, and you're going to pay for everything. It doesn't sound like you were in that situation, right?
I was not. And it was one of those things where my dad was a good guy, and he sort of was a blue-collar kind of roll your sleeves up, and he would go around and ask for advice from the bigger teams, and they would throw us a go-kart. They would throw us their old tires.
So he started in kart racing.
Karting from eight. You had to be eight to race then, and just evolved up through local, regional, state, and then international karting, and that was sort of the way to get a scholarship. My first scholarship came from Elf Fuel Company from France. I moved over to Europe racing single-seater, small formula cars.
How
and
old
the rest.
Were you?
When I moved first to Italy, I was 16, wow. racing go-karts, and then to France when I was 17. I lived at Le Mans inside of the gates of the actual 24-hour racetrack. We practiced and studied in a college, racing college, where we went to school during the week and raced on the weekends.
Wow, so, that's really cool. That now, were you winning a lot as a kid?
Not always. It ebbed
was there
and flowed.
No baseball or any? I mean, you know what I'm saying? Just none of it.
I tried just, it. I sucked at it, and I just wanted to be in my go-kart.
What did you think you were? What, baseball?
I played baseball, soccer, hockey, and enjoyed them. But in the end, what it actually came down to was when I was about 13 or 14, I had to miss so many games to be at the racetrack that it was a decision I had to make.
So you get on the track and you're 8 or 9 years old in a go-kart. Are you just killing it? Are you just – do you feel at home in that moment? You go – and are you winning races? Are you the kid in the town? Yeah. Are you a natural?
I think so. At that age, at eight, I was winning by my third race and in crappy equipment. But then
– With no training. Nobody
– No. Pretty much just feel. I was smooth, but I wasn't aggressive. I was good in qualifying, but in the battles, I was a little bit timid. So at about 13 –
Did you ever get hurt?
Run into, run over, you know, wheel marks on your neck.
I mean, but I have a 9 and 7 year old and they still cry, you know, if they get hit in the head with a football. Yeah.
You could get a go-kart in the back of the head. You're crying on the ride home. You know, probably concussed, but back then.
Is dad telling mom what's going on? Is
no,
she at the track?
No.
Don't tell your mom.
Don't tell your mom.
That wheel mark's nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. So
the wheel mark on your face.
There was no internet. There was no Twitter. They didn't know what was going on.
Wow. That's really exciting. That is really cool. So where is the storied big moment where you become a professional racer? Like, how did you get discovered?
That's one of those things like trying to be discovered in Hollywood racing. There's so many kids out there that are trying to tell you they're the best, and they're winning races, but in the end, it's an expensive sport. At about 20, I had been in Europe for a few years, sort of sleeping on couches, begging for rides. I had some good opportunities, some good results, but some rough years as well. 2002, I was teammates with Lewis Hamilton in Manor Racing in England in Formula Renault. Won some races, but finished sixth or so in the championship and really wasn't making the headlines. He was. Mm-hmm. I was out of luck. I was out of time. So I was kind of looking at moving home and getting a real job working for my family wood shop. And Red Bull called up and said, we're going to do a Formula One driver search for an American. We have the U.S. Grand Prix. We have no American driver. Corporate America is not stepping up. So an Austrian energy drink company is going to step up. They're going to search high and low. They employed Danny Sullivan to be sort of their mentor, godfather. And he went out and plucked people from short tracks and dirt racing, go-karts, everything. And, of course, I was sort of one of the favorites as a single-seater already being in Europe because that's where they were going to test us. And that's what they were looking for was a European-bred American. And I flunked. I went in overconfident. I made it from 16 to 6, and then they took 4 of the 6, and I wasn't on that short list. So
wow.
I went to Monaco crushed. That night and got really drunk and thought, that was the last time I drove a car. And the next morning, Porsche called and said, we saw something the Austrians didn't. We were there undercover. They allowed us to be there. Come to Weissach, test one of our GT cars, and let's see what happens.
Wow.
The inflection point we talk about.
Yeah,
the turning point. Luck, opportunity.
It's not our theory, but it's the head of Harvard Business School talks about how failure doesn't have to be failure. It can be an inflection point. There can be it's a moment for you to succeed if you're looking at it differently. This one is happening not by his choice, though, Zuckerman. This one just ricochets off and Porsche saves the day, but an inflection point nonetheless.
Nonetheless.
What an amazing story, huh?
Yeah, because it could have been Sandy.
All right. Well, now that you've been to the factory, let's. What do you know? So we heard we were in Monterey a few weeks back, and there was a meeting with the 918 guys, the VIP program, of which – by the way, I'm not a member of the VIP. You're not a VIP, Zuckerman.
Well, that's Jerry's fault.
Right. Yeah, he is. He didn't go to the meeting, but they talk about all the new stuff that's coming out, right? Touring and then they make them sign little agreements that they can't talk about.
They promptly breach. And
yes.
I won't say who, but they
Well, good. So you guys know more than me, and then I don't have to be getting in trouble.
Do they, as a Porsche factory driver, do they fill you in on the new stuff coming down the pipe, or are you just waiting like everyone else?
Partly. I mean, there is a whole separate team of drivers, engineers mm-hmm. that do cross over in some ways. I mean, Dr. Valasar, who's the head of motorsport, is also the head of GT cars.
Mm-hmm.
So we get little hints. But I mean, it's best to be on a need to know basis and
right.
not have to keep secrets. But we do see a lot of things when we go for meetings, when we go for checks, when we go to shake down a race car. We see a lot of cars inside the gate that are camoed up, so you can
yeah.
put two and two together and
right.
kind of understand that that's definitely not a Boxster, even though from the outside with some of the camo, they actually put pieces on the car. It's not just putting a camo livery wrap on it, but there are pieces of bodywork that confuse you. They cover the lights with different shapes.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's fun to see that sort of candy land being produced. I remember seeing the GT2 RS for the first time, and the exhaust was what stuck out to me being
really?
Sort of integrated into the bumper. And when I talked to one of the designers, he said, "We're really having a hard time making this exhaust go away. It's too big. It's too bold. It's not in the right place." And I was like, "Man, that's the best thing about that car. You know, it looks like a
yeah.
an offshore boat.
Make it big and make it noisy." I like when I go to these little press events and there's, Andreas Pruninger is there and Hurley Haywood. And we all know there's going to be a 911R, but they can't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And you ask them questions about it.
And sometimes you're frustrated.
Well, I would say, look, let's just say there's going to be a 911R. But if there were, hypothetically, how much weight would be out of this car next to what, a standard GT3? And Pruninger's like, "Well, how much weight do you want to take out of the car?" And, of course, Jerry and Paul and I have all talked about it, that we thought if 400 pounds were taken out of a GT3, that would be interesting to us. And I said, "Well, 400 pounds." And Pruninger put his drink down. He goes, "400 pounds? You know what I tell people like you, Spike? I go, why don't you lose 100 pounds instead of me?" He goes, "You're a thin guy, but I tell the most Americans, these fat Americans, you lose 100 pounds. Stop asking me to lose 100 pounds."
Yeah, don't
but he was
let
your joking.
Friend drive.
He was joking, but he was also just a little angry that he hadn't hit that mark. Because the 911R is how much lighter? Do you even know? 200 kilograms lighter? No, it's not even that much, right?
It's not a lot. It's not 100. It's 50 pounds or something.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not a lot.
But we also talked about, well, what else could you pull out of it? You pull the air conditioning out. That infuriated him.
Right.
That is, you take out the air conditioning, you take out the radio, and he goes, "Let me tell you something. I just drove." He's already been asked all of these questions. By the way, I felt like a Star Wars nerd in that moment. Do you know what I mean? Bothering J.J.
Right.
Abrams with dumb questions about the snow leopards or something. And I felt like the quintessential comic book nerd in that moment.
And that runs up against very German dry culture. Too,
right,
when
right.
you're excited and asking. And that's, I always wonder, how do you fit in that? Can you speak German?
Yeah, I speak enough to get by. But, I mean, look, Andreas, for instance, that guy speaks better English than I do.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, it's insane. And the ambassadors and the role developers, that's kind of par for the course. But the culture is different, especially when you go to a small village in Vysok.
Are you treated as one of the guys at this point?
Yes and no. I think racing drivers have a mixed review from internal team members. Obviously, we carry the cake across the line, but there's a lot of work that goes on behind the scenes. So I think if you understand the cars, if you're a fan of the history, we talk a lot about vintage cars and the new products. So yeah, I think with Andreas and the GT team, it's pretty close to the motorsport side. He actually uses us for feedback, which we've never had in previous generations, where he'll throw us a development car. I went out in the Gen 2 GT2, GT3, in Vysok and ran a loop that he does on public roads and gave him feedback on compliance and high frequency bumps and things like that. So we speak the same nerdy engineering language, and,
mm-hmm.
and he sometimes wants a fresh view from a racing driver who's not a guy who's been in the car every single week as they've developed the car, because sometimes they don't get that just black and white feedback.
He was he went back to, he goes, "I just had two 911s, one with the radio and the air conditioning deleted, so you save all this weight." And we're on the highway next to each other. "I have everything, the radio and the air conditioning, and we're even up to 120 miles an hour. And then my car starts to pull away a little bit. but it was raining, Spike, and the guy could not see because he had no air conditioning. And he starts screaming at me. That's what happens when you take air conditioning out. You can't use this car in the rain. And he stormed off, tipped the table over. Hurley Haywood was apologizing. Yeah, by the way, that day, that was in Road they took me out to Road Atlanta to drive the GT4 and the GT3 RS. And Hurley Haywood, it was the first sunny day after four rainy days. And Hurley's like, you ready to go out? It's 7:30 in the morning. I'm drinking. I've had 10 coffees. That's it. And flew the night before. And I said, Hurley, I've never been on this track before. And I don't pretend to be a race car driver. And you've got me now the first lead car behind you and two other journalists who I think are really cool. So I don't want to embarrass myself. But can we just do a couple of laps so I can see when I come up over a hill if I'm going left or right? Hurley goes, yeah, no problem. And then he proceeds to just light the track on fire on the first lap. I'm flying around in the GT4 and seeing what that car can do, driving beyond my abilities, you know, sliding into turns, but loving it, very controllable. But it's the only time I've ever made myself sick to my stomach in a race car driving. It happens when I do a ride-along and definitely if I get in a backseat, but we were going so bloody fast. And there's a walkie-talkie next to me, and Hurley's got one in his car, and he's just screaming at me, stay in my bumper! You're too slow! You know, he's got a German accent. Fat American! You're too slow! You lose 100 pounds so you can catch me! The whole thing was demoralized. He's like, what, 80 years old?
Well, he's getting up there, but
he
still goes fast.
He's an incredible driver. Yeah. And you know, I don't know. You don't strike me as one of these guys, like Brian Vickers, I don't know if you know who he is.
Yeah.
Dempsey. You get these guys on a track and they're monsters. Like their eyes suddenly light up and then they can't drive slowly. They attack. Is that what you're like when you get out there?
Pretty much. especially a place like Road Atlanta. I was thinking about that layout. And you rolling up off of a red eye with 10 coffees coming through your nose. That's a little bit like following a pro skier off piste through the trees and rocks, and you're just doing what he does, but you have no idea.
Oh, I was caught. You know, imagine I'm right behind him, but I've got two other guys. I can't remember who it was, but a guy from Drive, not Harris, Mike Spinelli.
Right.
It was Mike Spinelli and somebody else, but guys I watch on the internet, right? And I'm an automotive enthusiast. I am not an automotive journalist. You know, I'm not a guy who does this all the time. But I was feeling the heat. And you're coming down that, I don't know, this one turn where you're doing about, in the GT3 RS, 140 to 160, and then it's pretty much a dead stop and left turn, and then you come around to the front. And as you come around there, that's where you're coming up a hill, and it bears right. But I've never – I don't even think I've been to Atlanta.
So yeah, it basically
I'm
is like a cliff. Yeah.
I'm going up going, all right, let's hope that car went right with Hurley Haywood in it. What was incredible about the experience, and it was, I think, a little bit of what you get at the Porsche driving experience, but more, was seeing what these cars were designed to do. That's what I told this guy and Seinfeld. I was like, you don't even know what a GT3 RS can do driving this thing on the street. This thing is an aerodynamic machine that only sort of reveals itself over 150 miles an hour, right?
Yeah. It's the racing side of it has always been Porsche's development backyard. I think one thing that I kind of pro Porsche on is that if you take a GT3 to the track, you can beat it up all day long. You don't need to cool it off. You don't need to come in and let the brakes cool down. I see so many kids who talk about, wow, this car does 0 to 60 and this car does this, you know, 100 to 0 in stopping. Mm-hmm. I said, but can you take it to the track and hammer it all day long? And even if you're not a track guy, at least knowing that that car is going to be reliable as much as you want to hammer it, wherever you want to hammer it, that's probably one of the proudest moments of being a part of the Porsche family.
So as a this is a different question. Professional racer. You know, can you make a living doing that? I know you're a Porsche guy, but let's say you're not. You're living in Southern California. Is it the type of thing where you get a call and they go, hey, let's race NASCAR this weekend, or let's do sprint cars, or how does it work?
Certainly, it's tough. You have to hustle.
Do you have an agent?
A lot of guys have agents, managers. They're part of teams. But I think in all of it, whatever it is, you've got to go out and attack it yourself. You have to differentiate yourself and convince these private team owners or these manufacturers that not only do you have the goods, but you have the love and the work ethic. And it's the same in anything.
And
you have to push yourself to the top.
And what is the age? Like, is there an age like football where you're considered too old to race?
I'd say there's guys that make it into their 50s, but they are really physically fit. I mean, if you mm-hmm. look at a guy like Scott Pruitt, who's mid-50s, late-50s, mm-hmm. I mean, that guy doesn't have an ounce of body fat. He works out every single day. And beyond that, they have to have this love. I mean, Hurley Haywood still goes out and loves to pound laps
he's
all
amazing.
Day long. So you have to be obsessed to be an expert, whatever that saying is. So there's a little bit of all that. But I would say there's probably 30, 50 guys in the country who make a six-figure salary weekend to weekend, just hustling for $5,000-$10,000 a race here and there.
Wow.
And then there's maybe 10 Americans who have a factory gig with one of the big OE manufacturers, whether that's a combination of coaching and testing cars in the week and then racing on the weekends, or some of the few who are lucky to race the big ones, Le Mans, Daytona, etc. And it's not a bad gig. It's a short window, so you mm-hmm. sort of have to not go out and blow it on big cars and
right,
big boats
right.
and kind of, you know, invest for the future. But it's a great journey. You travel the world and you learn a lot about cars, but sometimes you have to kind of step outside the car dork side of things and learn about the rest of the world, because we race on the weekends. We're never home when our friends are off work. And then
right,
we're home
right,
during the week,
right.
so it gets a little bit different.
What happens when you're sick? Like Saturday, you're sick, you feel the flu coming on. What happens?
You drive.
You just
and
drive.
You drive hard, and you drive for 3-4 hour stints. You have a couple hours off, and you get back in the car. If you get to a point where you're dehydrated enough, then your other two driving teammates have to pick up the slack, and you're not their favorite guy, so you better be green in the face and sitting there in a wheelchair.
Have you ever puked in a car?
Oh, yeah.
Really?
Not just that. I mean,
what
it
do
comes
you mean?
Out of all ends of you, but it's what you have to do. Endurance racing.
So this
is
like
is
being an
fun.
Astronaut in the 60s, like the Apollo. So anything that happens to you, you got to go to the bathroom, you got to puke, it just goes right into the suit.
Yeah, I mean, that's extreme because we don't do 24-hour races every weekend. But when you're at Le Mans
yeah.
and nature calls, you're there to win. And this day and age, we run 110% the whole race. We can push these cars so hard, the driver can't be the weak link or you'll be looking for a different
and
type
how
of job.
And how long is your little run? Do you do an hour? Do you do 2 hours in the car?
Are we talking about the stint? Yeah.
Yeah.
We can go up to 3 hours. Any 4-hour time period in a 6-hour is a maximum a driver can do. So that could be two-hour stints. Or we run at Le Mans 3-hour stints, so 3 tanks of fuel. And that's about all you really want in a car.
So you go to the bathroom in your pants.
At
do you,
speed.
Do you wear a diaper at 200 miles an hour? What do you eat?
Is it hard to pee at speed?
It is. Adrenaline, actually. Adrenaline is
Let's
is
get
a,
into this.
Is, that's a great painkiller. So you really don't feel
the
urge to go until you get out of the car unless
right,
you're sick. So
right,
that's a
right.
good part. I did the Baja 1000 in 2013.
Oh,
and
that's rough.
I was subjected to what the off-road guys do, because sometimes they do a 6 or an 8 hour stint, which we're not allowed to do for safety reasons. And they have a really relief system.
And what does that mean?
It's a very large capacity condom that you just glue
yeah.
on, and it comes
that.
Out your race suit and
where does
sits
it go?
Below your seat.
Oh, Zuckerman, we could get this for
need,
our cars out here for
this
traffic.
For work,
yeah,
so I can be more productive.
I want it for right now.
I just want it right now for work.
I want to look you in the eyes and go, "I'm going to the bathroom right now."
And then I say, "Me too." And we stare at each other.
What about number two? What do they do?
I hope no one's listening to
what
this
kind of
meals.
A condom. What kind of a condom works for that?
That's Nomex. That's all you got, Nomex. So
you
four
just
layers
go right
of
in your pants.
You definitely won't do that, because then you'll be driving the rest of the race yourself.
Well, Patrick, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for coming in. I enjoyed hearing about professional racing. And once again, realizing I don't think I'm ever going to be able to do this. I don't have the talent for it, nor do I want to wear – well, I do want to wear a giant condom that I can pee in. You know, do you ever hear this, Zuckerman? Did you ever hear about Matthew McConaughey supposedly had built a van that he drove around L.A. in back in the day, and he had that condom system, and the tube went to a hole in the floor of his van, and he would
really?
Just drive around peeing?
What do you think? That could be patented. It could be called Spike's Peniculator. It could just...
I've been looking for a product to front, and this
your
might
face
be...
on that product would be perfect.
So I have my face on the condom itself
yes.
as it slips over.
Smiling and laughing.
And you can do the number two. And it'll be a package with that and then Zuckerman's number two system.
And I say, your number two is my number one.
Yes. Right. Patrick, thank you so much for coming in, man. It was a
Thanks.
Real pleasure.
It's been fun to talk about bowel movements.
All right. Well, we'll see you next Loop to Come.
Thanks for listening to Spike's Car Radio. Download new episodes every Wednesday on the Podcast One app or subscribe now at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.